Most histories of the War of the Roses focuses so much upon the affairs of the great and the good, of the Yorkists and the Lancastrians, that they often overlook the smaller people, the regular souls who had no dynastic stakes in this conflict, and to whom which side you decided to choose came with high risks. London and its population was one of those places. Over the last few episodes, we have covered the story of London as it picked a side, settling, for various reasons, upon the faction led by the Duke of York and now his son. And in doing so, London had become a Yorkist city. Actually, I think it's fair to say London had become the Yorkist city. But what exactly did that mean on the ground? What were the implications for London now in the aftermath of the victory of Edmund IV? That's what this chapter intends to find out. Hi, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, the podcast that tries to tell the chronological history of the city as a single narrative, racing along, sure, but happily taking its time to stop along the way and examine in detail the smaller people and their lives. And in this episode, we happily look at London in the wake of Edward IV's victory. What was life like for the Yorkists of London? And how did the Wars of the Roses impact upon people economically and therefore politically as things went forward? Welcome then to the 167th chapter of this story, Yorkist London. So we start with one fundamental truth. With Edward IV, the son of the late Duke of York, seizing the throne of England. This meant the cabal of members of the Grocers' Livery Company of London, the Grocers' Guild, so to speak, who had supported first the Duke of York and now his son, were fully vindicated. They had clearly chosen the winning side. But it is worth repeating, this group was merely one faction of one livery company in a rather big city. And as much as they had gained a victory, they now needed to turn this into a vindication of some kind. They now needed to convert their victory into power. You can see proof that this is what they wanted to do by the way this faction within the Grocers' Company immediately tried to consolidate their power over the rest of the Grocers' Company. Oaths were now introduced for every member of the livery company, which stressed, firstly, the loyalty they must give to Edward IV and his heirs, and secondly, their obedience to the wardens and guys who were now running the company. And when I say everyone had to swear this new oath, I mean everyone. Sure, the apprentices and the freemen, but that also included the clerks and even the company's porters. And on the 3rd of February, 1463, an ordinance was passed within the company which said that if anyone who broke their oaths should be expelled from the Grocers' Company. There was to be no dissent or going back on the company's commitment to Edward IV. The other grocers did not resist the rise of these Yorkists, mostly because they were driven by the belief that the new king had the interests of London's merchants at heart. Certainly, he was able to talk to them with knowledge, with some knowledge, of how trade worked when he dined with them in Grocers' Hall, something he did a few times during this decade. Edward IV had engaged in numerous commercial ventures in his own life, and his encouragement of English enterprise overseas has actually earned him the title of the first merchant king in English history. This was the grocer's type of king, and maybe more than just the grocer's. I mean, think about it. For the merchants of London, after virtually centuries of striving against the policies of royal governments, which had done little to protect English trade and had used the city's merchant class as a piggy bank to be raided from to fund military ambition, the merchants could feel justifiably optimistic in 1461 that this king was different, that this king would bring about better times, even if, you know, the economy was currently in the toilet. Edward showed his gratitude for the part the Londoners had played in his rise, and also for the various loans they'd given him lately, which amounted to about 11 grand, by a huge gesture. Early in his reign, he granted the mayor, the alderman, and the commonalty of London in August 1461 all those offices in the city connected to the regulation of trade, which under his predecessors had become prey to court favourites. All of them. All trade in London was to be regulated by Londoners. The Yorkist grocers had just won a huge victory for the city. As an example, amongst these posts that were now being given out, there was the one of the Garbleship of London. That's a tax collecting post to do with spice importation into the city, you know, items like pepper. As recently as January 1461, this post had been taken from the Londoners by a clerk of the King's Spicery, as ordered by Henry VI. In response to this, you'd seen the London Mercers Company issue an edict as late as June 1461, which forbade their members from seeking an office by, quote, sinister labour at court, unquote. So now, under the new king, this was given to the Londoners, and the Grocers' Company decided to make sure only the most trusted people would hold that post. In October 1461, Mayor Richard Lee's son-in-law, John Stokes, was appointed the man in charge of the garble, not in the customary fashion by nominations of the grocers' wardens, but at the single request of Sir John Fogg, the treasurer of the royal household and one of the king's most trusted servants. This indicates a fluid, working relationship between the Grocers' Company and the royal court. And as a side effect of that, this encouraged prominent grocers to give the king more loans, and they received more personal favours in return. We can see this when you look at the grocers and what happened to them. Thomas Young was made a sergeant at law. Richard Lee received from the king the grant of the advowson of St. Stephen's Walbrook Church, which later passed to the Grocers' Company. His brother, a joiner by trade, was made a keeper of the Tower of London. John Clerk, whose father had also been a prominent member of the company, was appointed the king's personal apothecary at a fee of about 8 pence a day. There's another grocer who benefited considerably, a man called John Nicol. He gained the contract to supply hundreds of pounds worth of gunpowder to the new Master of Ordnance. The supply of gunpowder was actually an offshoot of the grocer's traditional trade in saltpeter. John Nicol's connection with the court probably explains the appointment of his brother, Henry, as clerk of the Grocers' Company at Michaelmas in 1460. You see, previous to this, the clerk had been a man called Thomas Hulverwood, but it seems as if the Yorkists in the company were not sure about his loyalty to the Yorkist faction, like they could be sure about members of the Nicholls family, and so Thomas was pushed out and Henry Nicholls was made clerk. For the other livery companies and powers in London, they saw instantly that the way into the King's Court was to use the back door provided by these close relations. The new mayor of London, a mercer called Hugh Wisey, early in his term asked that the grocers' chief men should go to Westminster to speak to the king about things like renewals of royal grants to the livery companies. And they did similar visits by the grocers to EC taking place in 1465, and there's others in 1467 and 1468. I mean, back then, the grocers paid for a boat hire to Chelsea to see the king. So, this Yorkist faction in the Grocers' Company firstly consolidated control over their own livery company, and then became the main bastions of political influence for London on the new regime. And in all ways, the political elite of London, the aldermen, the manifestation of the livery companies of the city, found that Edward IV was their type of ruler. And they now had a relationship with the king, the like of which they could not remember ever being so good with any other king. Indeed, from the point of view of this podcast, The Story of London, I think we'd be hard-pressed to find a king whose interests so aligned with the city as this one. I think we have to go all the way back to King Stephen, or even Edmund Ironsides, to find a king to whom the elite of London found such commonality. From the position of the city of London, the king was on their side. Boy, did they need him. Because any way you look at it, the last bunch of civil wars from 1459 had undermined commercial activity and financial confidence in the city so badly that it had reduced to a trickle both trade and the flow of credit, which was already pretty hard hit by there being a national shortage of coin. In the previous years, things had been so chaotic, no one had been certain of the security of any loans they might lend to anybody. In fact, they weren't even sure about the safety of the city itself. They'd seen the likes of William Breton, who had taken valuables worth about 500 marks of silver out of the city to hide in the countryside just in case the city was sacked. And he was probably not being unique. Foreign trade with the city had also slumped, and it was so bad that the grocer's company actually had to stop dealing in spices. And that's the original trade its members had dealt with. If you remember going back many, many chapters, the grocers had come out of London spices. But because the demand for expensive spices now just fell off the scale, the grocers stopped dealing in spice. We see the impact of this massive recession in February 1462, when those who paid the farms, or the compulsory taxes on spice importation, actually were able to successfully plead for a reduction in what they owed the state due to incredibly low levels of trade. And it wasn't just in spices that trade had fallen off. There was a corresponding decline in the imports of dyes and alum. And this was going on because there was a huge drop in the exports of English cloth. The continuing depression of the grocers' wholesale and retail trade, which had led them to abandon trading in spices, ultimately meant they had to find other ways of keeping up their income. So they came up with a new policy: keep as much cash as possible in ready money so they could lend it at incredibly high interest rates. The real money was to be made in finance. Yeah, the old money pit of London was always a regular source of wealth. And the grocers were lucky in this at first. They could make big loans to the wool staplers, who could offer them the collateral of repayment from the money they made from wool customs. However, given the nature of the economic chaos right now, there were few other borrowers who could offer similar collateral and security. The low number of pardons for debt recorded between 1461 and 3, of which London's share slumped to as little as 10%, reflect the difficulty which people had encountered before Edward's victory at Taunton in raising credit in London. If you want an illustration of just how little confidence and how little coin was available in London in the immediate aftermath of the Civil Wars, look no further than a loan a London mercer made to a regional chapman, one of those itinerant merchants who travelled around selling goods from London to the countryside. The mercer charged chapman an interest rate of around 24%. So this meant that besides making speculative financial loans, the members of the grocers' company and others now turned to investments in property in the early 1460s as a way of increasing their income. We see the grocers' company actually start becoming landlords. Their most ambitious scheme was a demolition between 63 and 65 of their property at the Stocks and its rebuilding, which was considerable investment. It cost them over £94 to do this. They also took the risky decision to move the great beam from the warehouse at Bucklesbury to a new site in Cornhill, which was more spacious and more convenient for trade in the city. And they then converted the buildings in Bucklesbury to as a domestic quarters for 10 tenants, who included the weyer, the porters, three priests and three widows. Speculate to accumulate. But another effect of the political crisis and the continuing shortage of coin is seen more clearly in the fact that 10 grocers were obliged to pay their membership of the company in goods rather than in cash in 1462. 7 of these 10 grocers were established members of the company, who never normally were reduced to such means in order to keep up their membership. Some of them, like Ralph Riplingham, were in trouble because they could not get their customers to pay what they were owed. Others, such as Thomas Tree Bollance, they'd kind of overreached themselves and could not repay what they had borrowed from others. And another grocer, John Shelley, well, we know he appeared on a list of desperate debts of a London mercer who had evidently lost all hope of recovering any cash from them. It got so bad that a petition was presented to Parliament in 1463 by the craftsmen of London complaining of their impoverishment and asking for protection from foreign imports, all of which point to the ongoing difficulties of the domestic market. We even see the grocers finally cut the costs of paying for the actual livery its members wore, as wannabe members were unable to afford to buy the costly robes that came with, well, wearing the livery. And this is actually pretty significant. After 100 or more years of the livery company resisting any cutting back in the cost of their livery, them doing so now provides perhaps the most compelling evidence of the way in which this recession, in the aftermath of the Battle of Taunton, was really eating into people's personal wealth and the expenditure of London's grocers. However, while we can say the grocers' members were suffering financially in the aftermath of the civil wars, the fact they remained the second richest of the companies after the Mercers tells us that the members of the other livery companies were also being hit, not just this one company. I mean, when the livery companies were assessed in September 1462 to contribute to defend Calais, the grocers paid £28. Compare that with the Mercers, who paid 30, and the drapers, who paid 26. In November that year, they were called upon again, this time to raise £1,000 to lend to the king. Once more, the grocers raised the second highest amount, £112. And compare that to the Mercers, who raised £120. But as much as they were being reduced financially, by 1463, the grocers had 7 aldermen in office, a number only equaled by the drapers' company. So it seems that their declining economic fortunes was balanced by maintaining and growing their political influence. For now. Yet, where they and everyone has issues was protecting and developing overseas trade. Londoners found the king was sympathetic but not entirely behind them. For example, when it came to the Germans, the Hansards, the representatives of the Hanseatic League of German merchants, London merchants wanted the crown to force the Hansards to grant the English the same kind of privileges in the Baltic which they granted to the Germans in London, where the steelyard was still strong at this time. When the city tried to oppose the renewal of the Hanseatic trading privileges in 1461 by enlisting the help of the Parliament, the king asked the mayor not to push the issue and confirmed for the time being all the privileges that had given the Germans advantages that no other foreigners got. This allowed them to export cloth cheaper than anyone else. These privileges would become more contentious because the monetary difficulties which affected the Italians' trade was actually allowing the Germans in the steelyard to gain a greater share of London's cloth exports, and they paid for this by a matching growth in their own Germanic imports. The merchants in Cologne, in particular, imported quantities of ash, soap and other metals, which were weighed by the great beam, but their imports of linen and their overwhelming concentration on exports of cloth to the markets of southern Germany meant that by the 1460s they were predominantly the trading partners as well as the rivals of the Mercers. And because of this, very few grocers ever traded with them. The rise of the Mercers Company, in terms of being the premium livery company dealing with foreigners and foreign markets, was confirmed by the rise of another group within London closely linked to the Mercers, the Merchant Adventurers. This was a fraternity made up of London merchants who banded together to help export materials from England to foreign markets. Although the adventurers included in their fellowship members from other mercantile companies, such as the drapers, the haberdashers, the fishmongers, as well as the grocers, the Mercers dominated its membership. And they provided all the overseas governors, as well as the London headquarters and the clerks of the adventurers' office located in Mercers Hall. By 1465, the merchant adventurers were holding meetings which was separate from those of the Mercers Company. And they also had their own court and overseas governors. So it seemed that they were this new independent force, focused on the export trade of London. However, the Mercers always held control over the merchant adventurers' affairs during this period. And in the years to come, they were to use their numerical and economic strength to blackmail the other companies who made up the membership by threatening to secede and to ship independently. And this really signified a change in the political and economic relationships between the livery companies in London. Back when the exports of cloth had been soaring and credit had been abundant, individual mercers and grocers had traded with each other and belonged to the fellowships, both of the wool staples of Calais and the merchant adventurers of London, kind of as partners. But the depression of London's cloth trades between 1457 and the late 1460s changed that. This depression had begun with the Burgundian ban on English imports, but then had been driven onwards and been caused mostly by falling demand throughout Europe. And it meant that those merchants who were not wholly committed to the cloth trade found it difficult to survive in what was to become a fiercely competitive market overseas. Some of that competitiveness now began to manifest itself as a struggle between the wool staplers and the merchant adventurers to assert their authority over trade in the Low Countries. The adventurers had even gone as far in 1455 as to imprison a servant of the mayor of the Calais staple when he was travelling in the Low Countries. The mercers were taking over foreign trade in London. It's significant that Simon Smith, one of the few London grocers in the 1460s who continued to export cloth, used a Colchester merchant, a man called Thomas Newland, as his export agent. It seems from a debt of £100 owed to two Colchester merchants to William Morrow's widow that he, another grocer, was doing the same thing. Colchester had developed its own close connection to the merchants of Cologne, and Newland and other Colchester merchants could therefore export cloth to Germany on behalf of London's grocers, who were probably supplying them with dyes and alum. And they were doing this so they could avoid interference by London's mercers and drapers. But away from this, because of the nationwide shortage of coin and bullion, merchants were now being reduced to barter goods to pay for things whenever possible, as the Medici in London found out when they had to barter wool for alum, and cloth workers had to accept payment in pins and girdles instead of money. This practice led to protests in Parliament and to the bitter denunciation in a political poem of the time, which demanded that more miners should be employed to dig up silver, quote, whereby that the working folk might truly be paid, unquote. We see examples of the impact of the shortage of cash at the lowliest individual level. For example, in 1463, an apprentice of a merchant called Simon Smith had to repay a debt of £10 he owed his master in woad and cloth, and then another debt he had to repay in canvas and ropes. The situation was so bad, barter economics are back on the table. And all of this made it more important to link exports to imports, which in turn meant that the channels of trade narrowed and became much less diversified. The solution to all of this was simple and brutal: a massive devaluation of the coinage of England in 1465, which had the double effect of increasing the number of coins in circulation and reducing the price of English cloth abroad, which in turn suddenly helped to stimulate the demand for raw materials for the cloth industry. This devaluation kick-started London's economy, and we see exports in cloth and tin begin to rise again from 1466. Interest rates also immediately fell, allowing credit to recover from the generally low level of 1460, even though the Medici Bank was still having to offer 12 to 14% to attract deposits in 68. We see a marked rise in the grocer's company rent after the devaluation also, rising from about £40 annually in the early 1460s to about over £60 by 1468. This rise suggests that the city economy suddenly recovered after the devaluation, so the demand for housing grew, and the membership of the grocer's company also increased. But with the revival of the economy, we see a change in how people traded. The falling cloth exports of the early 1460s had encouraged the exporters in the grocer's company to concentrate more on the wool trade. At least four grocers who were aldermen had interests in wool, and their influence was enhanced by the key positions enjoyed by men such as John Walden in the Staplers organization in Calais. The influence which prominent grocers such as John Walden, John Young, John Crosby and William Lemming had in the Calais Fellowship is shown by the decision of a stapler, who was a former sheriff of Lincoln, a man called John Colbeck, to join the grocers' company in 1461. There was a good reason to see the stapler faction was something worth investing in. At the end of 1462, the crown owed the stapler merchants just under £41,000, which they could owe because it was secured on the customs on the wool trade. The sheer size of what the king owed the wool staplers enabled the wool merchants to demand major concessions from the king. They presented a petition to Parliament in April 1463 that demanded that no foreigner should be allowed ever to export wool. And to their surprise, and everybody's surprise, the king agreed. It's most probably he'd committed himself to such a bargain actually back in 1461, when the support of the staplers in Calais and of their allies in London was crucial for the Yorkist campaign for the throne. But in any case, the major part of the wool customs was already going to the staplers, and therefore the king did not feel any immediate effects of cutting out the foreigners, and it, you know, he was hoping to compensate for it by the profits he would make from exporting wool himself, which he promptly did. The London members of the Calais staple were also granted another concession. In August 1463, the wool which passed through the Westminster staple was now being transferred to Leadenhall, where it's committed to the supervision of the mayor and the aldermen. And any opposition which might be expected from the Abbot of Westminster about this was completely ignored because of a loan of £1,000 given to him in the same month by the grocer alderman William Taylor. The staplers then had insisted that they should be paid at Calais in bullion or coin for at least half instead of a third of the value of their wool. One reason for this change in policy was that they had no other means of paying for the defence of the town of Calais. And that was their major expenditure, and since their income was exporting wool was so low, they needed the cash. But they became acutely aware of how much the shortage of coin before the devaluation was crippling the mercantile economy, and in particular, their own ability to pay the wool growers. You see, before the devaluation, unlike the merchant adventurers who could barter imported foreign cloth and linen for woolen cloth being given to them by their chapmen from across the country, the staplers had to pay their woolmen in coin, and they'd been obliged to advance interest-free credit to their customers at Calais because of this. And it meant that before the devaluation, the staplers were actually finding themselves squeezed at both ends because of the lack of coin. And the consequence of this was that the Calais staple could only survive by increasing their dependency on the mercers for advances of cash in London. And the mercers' company relished this opportunity as it increased their influence over foreign trade. They had no qualms about exerting pressure on Flemish merchants through the governor of the Merchant Adventurers of Bruges to sell their goods exclusively to members of their company. They were therefore able to increase their involvement in the staplers trade at the same time as the grocers found they were being squeezed out of the merchant adventurers markets. And so when the devaluation came, the staplers were weakened already, and they complained bitterly in 1457 that they were actually being threatened with utter ruin. Relations between the adventurers and the staplers were additionally strained by the renewal of licenses to export wool outside of the staple, and also by smuggling, and all that meant that wool again found its way in the 1460s, quote, by strange and sinister means, unquote, to Antwerp and other Burgundian markets, often without paying any customs. The grocers' company found, as the 1460s then progressed, that the new rising men within their ranks were no longer so eager to invest in the wool trade in the Calais staple, even though exports were increasing from the middle of the decade. Undoubtedly, this was because of high taxation of wool and the mercers' domination of the return trade from the continent. So for many of the new, richer members of the grocers' company, rather than get into the wool trade, they decided to turn to money lending as a way to generate cash. I mean, you actually saw this in the recovering economy of the later 1460s, you see a really big increase in the number of loans which prosperous grocers were making to gentry, both in London and in the provinces. Now, some of these can be explained by the increased involvement of the gentry in trade, but it's more likely that the majority were just loans to relieve the debtor from financial embarrassment and to give the creditor a better rate of return than he could get from investing in wool. Thomas Hill lent a gentleman of London and a squire of Kent £100 each. Thomas Hawkins lent a gentleman of the Essex village of Mucking the same amount. As a consequence of this, and without a new influx of grocers coming to join them, the staplers had to recruit men of more modest means to keep the Calais Fellowship growing. They increasingly did so by apprentices, which added to their numbers, but didn't add to their capital. Other guilds became involved in the staple. The expansion in the number of staplers and their recruitment from far more London companies meant that the grocers could no longer hope to dominate their council. By the 1480s, for example, the staplers were more likely to be represented by the poorer cloth-making livery companies than any of the great ones. Even so, the financial hold which the Mercers had obtained over trade meant that the grocers, going forward, meant that the grocers could not rival in numbers the 46 members of the Mercers who in 1480 called themselves Merchants of the Staple of Calais. You start seeing the more enterprising grocers now seek to exploit new markets in the hope of making cash. The London Customs account shows that Simon Smith and Thomas Bledlow were exporting cloth going to Spain or Portugal, where English merchants were importing increased quantities of wine, wax, fruit and oil. Thomas Bledlow was also importing oil from Spain to Bristol, and probably Simon Smith's imports of iron and oil in the 1460s and William Cardmaker's imports of red lead also came from Spain. For men such as these, trade with Spain and Portugal was but a halfway stage in their larger plans of breaking into the Mediterranean market. Only by establishing a commercial base in Italy had the grocers any hope of taking from the Italians the importation of alum, spices and dyes, which would give them a proper two-way trade. For this, the new king's support was crucial, and it was the more readily given because he was already exporting wool to Italy himself. The Florentines needed English wool for their fine textile industry, and the ban on their exporting from England meant that they had either to buy the wool dearly at Calais or to allow the English to ship it to the Mediterranean themselves. They found they had no alternative but to lift the discriminatory extra duties they normally imposed on goods imported in foreign shipping, and as a consequence, Porto Pisano was thrown open to foreign vessels on equal terms with the Florentine in 1465. London's merchants had waited for this opportunity for over two centuries, and they eagerly took up the challenge of expanding their Mediterranean trade. Grocers were prominent amongst the first exporters. John Young had permission to ship 375 sacks of wool in 1465 to encourage the import of bullion. Philip Hardbean, John Crosby and William Taylor were all shipping wool, lead, tin and cloth in 1469. With a value of up to £1,000. Later, John Crosby, in his will, was to leave £50 to a Florentine merchant as a mark of gratitude for the loyalty he had shown him, presumably as his agent in his Italian enterprises. However, this great opportunity in exporting wool to the Mediterranean was countered because the ban on foreign exports of wool was soon undermined by licenses which the king began to grant to many of his creditors, including Italian merchants. Gerald Caraziani, for example, was allowed to send wool worth over £5,000 to the Mediterranean, and later wool, cloth, tin and lead to a value of over £8,500 in repayment to his loans to the king. Such grants nullified what the English merchants had gained by what proved to be only a temporary ban on Italian exports of wool. The Londoners were also frustrated in the hopes of importing cargoes of alum in return. Bottom line, you see, it was not till the Florentine state galleys gave up their involvement in trade, which was going to happen in the final liquidation of the Florentine Medici Bank in 1478 in a future chapter, that the opportunity to take over the trade in wool and alum was fully open to the English and London merchants. But for the London merchants and the pro-Yorkist grocers, all of this trade stuff had a domestic political impact as well. The grocers had followed up the advantage they had gained from the diversion of much of the alum trade to London by taking the commercial offensive upon Southampton. The regime of John Payne and John Walker helps to account for the new pattern of Southampton's trade between 1460 and 63. Back in the 1440s, Southampton was sending the bulk of its woad to Salisbury, Winchester and the Midlands. But between 1460 and 63, they were sending it all to London, or at least most of it. But in 1463, Payne's campaign of intimidation and extortion against the Italians led the king, now no longer so dependent on his mercantile allies, to dismiss him as mayor of Southampton the following year, which saw London's share of Southampton's imports sink again. Nevertheless, Payne's rule of 2.5 years, combined with Genoa's loss of its monopoly in alum, had succeeded in driving much Italian enterprise away from Southampton back to London. Several young grocers from London also began to infiltrate Southampton's Mediterranean trade. Richard Bushbury and John Ward, with John and Richard Walker, were granted a license in 1466 to ship 400 broadcloths to the Mediterranean from Southampton every year for 10 years. The same year that Ward and Walker were importing £80 worth of sugar and raisins back into London. This was a small contribution to the overall importing of goods into London that year, but it was indicative of the ambitions of a small group of young grocers to establish a profitable two-way trade with the Mediterranean, and if they had to go via Southampton, then they would. John Ward, who was prominent amongst this group, had joined the livery company in 1461 and 62, and he became a warden of it 4 years later with the wool merchant Philip Hardbean. By 1478, John Ward was an alderman. Both the Walkers and Bushbury had joined the livery together as a group in 1463, in company with rising Southampton merchant John Blewitt, who had obviously decided that he could make more money from joining the Londoners than from opposing them. Since Blewitt's chief import was wine, his main motive for joining the company was to gain access to the London market. Richard Lee and Walter Hurt were amongst the older generation of grocers who gave them financial backing, and John Payne probably used his influence to support them until his death in 66. It's also likely that the company helped organise a new and successful campaign launched by the workers and John Payne's son Thomas in 1472 to recover for political power for their faction in Southampton, which led to John Walker of London being elected as mayor the following year. Ultimately, what this led to was that the grocers finally did, by 1470, really remove the Italians from Southampton. London finally in this era got to grips with putting to bed the threat of Southampton. But while it was taking place, we have to say, London was more than just a place where a consortium of rich grocers were aligning themselves to the new regime. The city's life did continue as normal in this era. There was quite a lot happening. On the 9th of November in 1462, a charter was issued to hold an annual fair just south of the city in Southwark. The Southwark Fair was to become second only to the Great Bartholomew Fair in North London, and indeed, the fair had existed already when the charter was issued. This was simply the authorities recognising this annual event was to take place yearly. The important, crucial part of the charter was the fact that London gaining the charter to formally hold the fair confirmed its jurisdiction over Southwark. Sure, Southwark was not formally part of London, but the fair's charter showed the city gaining power over it due to the favourable regime of Edward IV. And so the fair was established. And to help modern listeners visualise it, imagine a long line of stalls filled with medieval London merchants and regional chapmen who usually plied the roles of Kent and Sussex, taking up what we today call Borough High Street. The fair grew quickly, and from its base in Long Southwark, which is what Borough High Street was called back then, the event spread into the streets and alleyways alongside it. When it first started, Southwark Fair lasted from the 7th to the 9th of September, but gradually it would grow to become a 2-week event, South London's wild celebration of life. London during the 1460s was also prone to the usual hazards of city life, which did not care who was in charge of them. City life is city life. We know back in 1462 there was a very serious flood along the Thames, especially around Barking and Dagenham, which impacted the lands of the rather illustrious convent of Barking. And we have reports of a terrible public accident in London that year. A man called Robert Godwin was working on the final parts of the restoration of St. Paul's Cathedral. While below the cathedral proper was watching the city play out the grand games of politics and civil war, in the final stages of completing the spire of St. Paul's, which towered above the city, workers were guiding in a large weathercock to sit atop the spire. According to the account of the later antiquarian John Stowe, as they did this, quote, Robert Godwin, winding it up, the rope broke, and he was destroyed on the pinnacles, and the cock was sore bruised, unquote. Such accidents would be a source of London gossip as much as the affairs of the new king or the shortage of money or the barbers or tallow makers gaining charters to form their own livery companies, as they did going into 1463. You saw Ludgate Jail, which was the principal prison for people imprisoned for debt, be considerably enlarged and expanded, and one of London's finest medieval houses, Crosby Place, was started to be built in 1466 up in Bishopsgate. Oddly enough, that hall still survives. It's just moved to Danvers Street in Chelsea. And by 1469, we read of the roof of the nave of St. Mary Overy collapsed this year and had to be rebuilt in wood. So what do we have going on? We have a city which has won the War of the Roses. The Yorkists are in charge, and the Yorkist supporting members of the Grocers' Company have taken over their livery company and have established a firm political control over the city. But they weren't dictators. It was all about politics and of doing favours. London as a whole supported them. But London wasn't united. You started to see the Mercers' Company, who hadn't really been that involved politically and stuff, begin to flex their muscles. They were beginning to have a bigger say in foreign trade, what was their domination of the merchant adventurers, and now increasingly their domination of the staplers. The staplers were in decline. They were still very important. They ran and paid for the huge garrison in Calais, and that was the bedrock of the Earl of Warwick's armed forces. But all in all, Yorkist London was a place where the economic conditions forced political changes. It had only been a small cabal of Yorkist grocers who had supported the Duke of York from the get-go, and their motivation had been economic to begin with. Now, especially after the massive devaluation of currency, which did kickstart the economy, London began to look for new priority. The splits between the mercers and the grocers begin here, and the shape of a new series of conflicts within the city begins to emerge. Yorkist London, then, is a city of great complexity that will beget a most intriguing future, because it couldn't live isolated. It couldn't ignore the world outside beyond its walls. In time, the rest of England's affairs were to impact upon it again, because the War of the Roses was not over yet. Okay, I'm going to leave that one there. Another part coming out next week. Hope you could follow it. Very difficult part because there was so much to it and it was quite heavy and it was all economics and city politics. And yeah, occasionally we nerd out. Thanks for listening. Sorry if London were back again next week. See ya.